If it pleases the Court, my name is Mike Schabelsky from Hunton & Williams, arguing the recess appointment issue on behalf of both petitioners in this consolidated oral argument. One point both sides agree here is that the challenged appointments were intra-session appointments. The Board concedes that the new session of the Congress at issue began on January 3, 2012, and that an adjournment happened, and that an intra-session recess began thereafter, and the President made the appointments in question the next day on January 4th. Both sides also agree that the appointments at issue are invalid and the orders void if the recess appointment clause does not allow intra-session appointments. In other words, there is no savings clause or safe harbor that will save these appointments and the order and the orders, notwithstanding the violation of the recess appointments clause. Now, the Court has been presented with three possible interpretations of the recess appointments clause. One, which we advocate and which the D.C. Circuit and the Third Circuit have recently found is correct, is that the clause is limited to the recesses that occur between Senate sessions. A second interpretation would extend the recess appointment clause not only to those intercession recesses, but broadly to every adjournment the Congress or the Senate, rather, takes during a session. And then there's the third interpretation that the Board advocates, which is the President gets to decide whether the Senate is in recess, as long as his interpretation is, quote, reasonable, or his decision is reasonable. Now, Your Honors, no one advocates that second interpretation, the one that says the clause extends broadly to every adjournment. And so the question for the Court is, which of the other two interpretations best reflects the framers' intent?
Could we talk about the third one for a moment?
Yes, ma'am.
Because Noel Canning seems to assume that presidents use recess appointments to evade advice and consent. First of all, is there anything in the record to support that assertion? How about whether that's the case in the particular appointments here? I mean, it seems we're being asked to rely on facts that are not part of any record, and it also seems so unlikely that presidents would do this, given that recess appointments are temporary. So,
yes, ma'am, I would make two points in response to that. First, I think Noel Canning's Court's concern was more directed to the fact that the Board's interpretation would permit and facilitate and encourage the President to evade the advice and consent role of the Senate, that if that interpretation were adopted as law, then the President would have, there going forward, no incentive to engage in the political negotiations with the Senate to achieve acceptable nominees, and could therefore just wait to every adjournment or simply declare the Senate is not generally unavailable. And so I think it's more the concern of what would happen going forward, because historically, up until really recent times, until the Reagan administration, the presidents haven't been asserting the power to make these intra-session appointments. And so I think, Your Honor, that was really the gist of their concern. Now, looking at the appointments here at issue, I think one could fairly conclude that there was a frustration by the President, and he did, at least with respect to one nomination, never sought the advice and consent of the Senate, because one of the three seats that became vacant was that created by the expiration of the term of member Becker that expired on January 3rd, 2012. And the President, the very next day, then nominated someone to fill that vacant seat, never having previously submitted a nominee for that vacancy to the new Congress. So I think you can find that even that issue here on this record, Your Honor. And therefore, we have to decide, as Noel Canning and New Vista did, why is the interpretation that limits the President's unilateral appointment power to inter-recesses only the one that is objectively the more natural reading of the Constitution? Well, it's that interpretation, the intercession recess only one, that first gives meaning to the framers' different use of the term the recess in that particular clause, rather than the broader terms adjournment or adjourn that the framers used elsewhere in the Constitution. As the Supreme Court precedent tells us, the decision to use different words in the Constitution cannot be regarded as accidental and must reflect an intentional design on the framers' intent. And that intent comports with the structure that the clause is really talking about intercession recesses only. Because in the recess appointment clause, by referring to the recess, in contrast to when the Senate is in session, that is the dichotomy that is being drawn in the application in that specific clause. And indeed, that is further bolstered by the fact that the dichotomy is drawn between the recess and the ensuing session of the Senate. So in that particular context, it doesn't seem most natural that the framers were intending the recess to apply to any adjournment.
Yeah, but, you know, the NLRB contends, and that's at pages 52 and 53 of the red brief, that your reading of the phrase during the recess of the Senate as modifying the term happen would mean that the president could use the recess appointments process while the Senate is actually in session to fill vacancies that arise during a recess. And how do you respond to that textual argument?
Right. First, I would point out that that is a distinct issue from the question of whether or not the appointments have to be made inter-session versus intra-session. The issue that you're alluding to, Your Honor, refers to when must the vacancy arise. And that's a separate and independent ground. And if you were to conclude that the intercession interpretation is the correct one, you wouldn't have to decide that happen issue. But to then address, however, the happen issue, there's no question that as an abstract matter of grammar, the word happen in isolation is ambiguous. I don't think anybody questions that. I think all the courts addressing this issue have acknowledged that. Mm-hmm. But they say, what is the more natural use of the word happen in this context? It certainly seems more than passing strange that the framers wouldn't have said vacancies that exist instead of this strange construction the board is advocating where they say happen to mean happen to exist. They are trying to engraft a convoluted reading into that phrase happen for that purpose. But certainly no And further, for that particular point, I think the practical construction that both houses and the presidency have put on the clause for those 200 years since the Republic has not gone in that direction. And so the practical meaning is everyone understands that the happen means the vacancies happen to arise during the recess in question. But going back, if I might, to the intercession recess question, the intercession interpretation is also the one that avoids an inconsistent result, because under the board's reading, what could happen is some recess appointments would last one session of Congress, and others could last up to 2 years or more, two sessions of Congresses. And there's nothing in the Constitution and nothing in common sense that tells us the framers intended that inconsistency in the outcome here. Further.
But, you know, in your brief, and maybe you can help me with this, you didn't really address, well, in, I should say, in the FTS brief, didn't really address the opinions of the Ninth and Second Circuits that were cited at page 32 of the NLRB's brief regarding whether the vacancies must be filled in the same recess in which they arise. I don't know. You seem to be in a minority position on that issue.
Well, Your Honor, the two opinions I believe you're referring to are the Woodley and the Al-Lococo case, however it's pronounced. Now, those two opinions focus just on the happen issue because they were intercession recess appointments. And really, Your Honor, I think we now have in the circuits on that particular issue, I think a 3-2 split with the D.C. Circuit and the Third Circuit taking the view that the vacancy must arise during the recess, and the Ninth and the Second Circuits and the Eleventh Circuit taking the opposite view, although the Eleventh Circuit was a split opinion on the en banc panel there. But I think really what you can see from the Woodley and Alcoco case, if I pronounce it right, being somewhat older cases, really a lot of the arguments there weren't fleshed out as they had been in more recent cases. And we think the reasoning from the D.C. Circuit and New Vista is a sounder reasoning there. But also the intercession-only interpretation argument adopted by New Vista and Noel Canning also comports with what the Supreme Court has directed in these separation of power cases, is that bright-line rules and high hurdles are the appropriate approach to separation of powers, as opposed to vague standards, murky standards that will gum up and threaten the systems of checks and balances here. Also, the intercession-only interpretation really comports with the historical context in which the Constitution was drafted and ratified. At that time, as a historical fact, Congress anticipated relatively short Senate sessions punctuated by very long intercession recesses. And so there was no need to anticipate, really, the need to make intra-session recess appointments. What the concern was about the intercession breaks. Also, as I think everybody agrees from looking back at the debates on the Constitution, the Appointments Power Clause was an actual very controversial, heated topic. It was one of the last clauses to be resolved by the convention because you had two competing factions, one that wanted the power to vest solely in the president, the other that wanted to vest it in one or both branches of the Congress. And it was only until the very last minute that that got resolved by having a duality appointment. The president nominates, the Senate confirms with advice and consent. There is no discussion whatsoever in the historical record of the convention or the state ratifying conventions that anyone understood then the addition of the recess appointments clause to undo that structure and to give the power to the president to unilaterally declare when the Senate is in recess or otherwise generally unavailable to give him advice and consent and override the Senate's function. That would have been such a controversial outcome, so at odds with the resolution reached after nearly a year of heated debate, that it can't be what that interpretation is. There would have been some reference to that in the historical record.
For practical terms, the inter-recession gap is much narrower now, is it not?
Just as a matter of historical practice, but that.
No, I mean now it seems that the Senate is, as far as not recession or inter-recession, it's a very compressed time, where in the old days it was a very lengthy time. So I guess what I'm getting at is that with the inter-recession theme, there's lots of opportunity for advice and consent from the Senate.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. And further, the fact that the Senate is staying in session longer to do the people's business, as you say, is a prerogative that the Constitution gives to the Senate. The Constitution gives the Senate the power to decide the length of its sessions and its rules and procedures. And if it elects to stay in session for the balance or the most of a calendar year, that's its prerogative, and that's not a constitutional problem. And it gives the president even much more opportunity to obtain its advice and consent if the Senate is willing to give its advice and consent.
Well, you used the word evasive, I think. Is that, I think you did. That may be what some themes from the intra is, and to evade the advice and consent of the Senate.
No, I don't think, Your Honor.
Did you not use that word?
No, I think it was a statement from the bench about Noel Canning's take of it.
Well, I listened to everything she said.
and follows none of it.
Because, Your Honor, at the end of the day, I think really what the board is confusing here is the Senate's decision not to give advice and consent, its unwillingness, which is its prerogative, not to confirm a particular nominee, versus its inability to give advice and consent.
Speaking of the Senate, is one senator enough to constitute the Senate? I mean, with these pro forma sessions, that is the fiction under which the Senate is operating. How can we say, you know, the Senate is in session when no quorum is present? And you insist the board may not operate without a quorum. So how do we say that the Senate is in session during a pro forma session when there is no quorum?
Right. Well, pro forma sessions, Your Honor, are real sessions. They count for constitutional purposes. As I mentioned, the board concedes that the pro forma session on January 3rd, 2012 was a real session that convened the second session of the 112th Congress. It counts for the adjournment clause. It counts for the presentment clause. It counts for all the other clauses in the Constitution. And pro forma sessions, as the Congressional Recess Service says, don't differ in substance from other sessions of Congress. As the board acknowledges in footnote, I think it's 7 of its brief, in a pro forma session in December of 2011, the Senate passed legislation. These are real sessions of Congress. But also, Your Honor, I think the pro forma issue is ultimately a red herring, because these appointments here were not made on a day when the Senate met in pro forma session. Rather, they occurred the day after, when the Senate was in an intra-session adjournment. Because what the issue here is not what is the constitutionality of these appointments don't depend on the nature of the session that preceded that adjournment. Rather, it depends on the nature of the adjournment, that it was an intra-session adjournment rather than the recess that occurred between the sessions. And in addition, the long-established historical practice going over 150 years, essentially, before presidents began to assert this power of making intra-session recess appointments screams loudly, as New Vista and Noel Cannon acknowledged, that the understanding of the framers and in the early republic was that this type of appointment power did not exist. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal and ask you to set aside these orders for the reasons stated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schabowski. Ms. Brinkman?
May it please the Court, Beth Brinkman from the Department of Justice on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board on the recess appointments issues. As my counsel pointed out, the employers here are making three attempts to severely restrict the authority that the President has long exercised under the recess appointments clause. Their first and core argument is that that authority should be restricted and to only recesses that are between sessions and not recesses that are during sessions. But there is no such restriction in the text of the Constitution.
What about
does
the historical perspective of the last quarter of the century trump, or should it trump, the years before?
The history is very different from what the employer stated, and I'll get to that in a moment. There's nothing in there, we would say, that has that type of restriction. To the contrary, and there's no restriction in the purpose that goes to the separation of powers and the checks and balances. Really, what their argument boils down to is that the argument that only allows recesses between sessions is a bright line rule, and that is what's necessary. But there's not in those restrictions, and that is not the touchstone of constitutional adjudication. The Supreme Court has made that clear. The case of Morrison versus Olson is very informative in this regard. It was a separation of powers case. It was an appointments clause case. The question was whether or not the independent counsel was a principal or inferior officer. At page 671 of that opinion, the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Chief Justice Rehnquist, unequivocally explained how the line was not clear between those two different types of officers under the Constitution and went on to explain that the court was not going to attempt to decide exactly where a bright line was. They were deciding the case before them and what that officer, where the independent counsel fell within the constitutional framework. That's this court's tasks, and that's why we look to the text, the purpose, and the history.
Yeah, but and I appreciate that. Obviously, we've got a different factual setting between the special counsel and these appointments, General Brinkman. But is a bright line possible? I understand the court said that they weren't going to define it in Olson, but the Olson case. But is a bright line possible here? Isn't that what's being argued, that you could read the text and the history until 25, 30 years ago arguably gave us a bright line? Now, I'm not saying it's commanded. I'm just suggesting that it exists in theory, at least.
We would say not, Your Honor. And if I could first step to the text. The text, the enterprise we undertake is to determine what the meaning of the recess is in the Recess Appointments Clause. We look at what the meaning of that term recess was contemporaneous to the framers. First, the employers ignore the example of the Articles of Confederation involving many of the framers themselves. They appointed the Committee of the States for one period, which was an anticipated intra-session recess, clearly understanding the word recess, not to somehow exclude recesses or within a session. They also denigrate the fact that we point to the British Parliament. What we point to is Thomas Jefferson's manual on parliamentary procedure that the United States Senate employed. They also understood that recess did not exclude intra-session recesses. We also point to the contemporary understanding of state legislatures. Three constitutions, it was the Pennsylvania and Vermont Constitution, allow action during intra-session recesses that was about trade embargoes. The New York Constitution allowed the appointment of a committee on safety during an intra-session recess. That's what the word recess meant at the time of the framing. Now, the employers have pointed to a Massachusetts constitution, which is a much more complicated system with dissolution and prorogation, which is not what the framers adopted. Moreover, a 1791 opinion of the Massachusetts High Court makes clear that both inter- and intra-sessions are understood as part of that. So we think when you look at that, that is the meaning of the word recess at the time of the framers. There is no exclusion for recesses that are within a session.
What are the, or rather, are the employers correct that this is the first time in history that a president has made an appointment during a recess of fewer than 3 days?
We don't believe this was a recess of fewer days at all, Your Honor, and that goes to the second challenge they make. They take this recess and they try to eliminate it by pointing to pro forma sessions that the Senate convened. But as Your Honor pointed out, those are not working sessions of Congress. By unanimous consent order, the Senate had directed that no business be conducted during those nanoseconds. They were like 30-second gavels. That order of no business conducted meant that they had to have unanimity to do any type of business. Now, the employees have pointed to the fact that on December 23rd, in a different pro forma session, there was passage of legislation. But if you look at the congressional record, Your Honor, that session was turned into a working session. After that legislation was enacted, there are messages that were laid before the Senate. One of the things about the unavailability of the Senate under the longstanding interpretation of both the president and the Senate is when the Senate is unavailable to receive messages from the president. Those messages during the 20-day recess from January 3rd to January 23rd, there were no messages laid between the president. They were not laid before the Senate. They were not laid before the Senate until January 23rd when they came back from the recess. And while I'm on the pro forma point, I also want to point out they have no answer to the fact that on December 17th, the same day on the same page of the congressional record, when the Senate established these pro forma sessions and the recess from January 3rd to January 23rd, twice there are unanimous consent orders that refer to that period as a recess. It is not a confrontation between the branches here. The President and the Senate have long shared the common understanding. And if I could switch back to the intra-intercession argument, I wanted to get to your question about the history, Your Honor. This is not some kind of new power that started with President Reagan. To the contrary, Your Honor, there have been 14 presidents that have exercised appointment authority during intra-session recesses. The first dates back to 1867 by President Johnson. And if I just take a sidestep here for a moment, the Third Circuit kind of disregarded that because they pointed to the impeachment of President Johnson. It had nothing to do with recess appointments. It had to do with the Tenure Act. He was acquitted. The Supreme Court actually vindicated his interpretation of that statute. And the actual people that he, the 14 recess appointments that he made during intercession, were all confirmed by the Senate. The fact that there weren't more early intra-session recess appointments is because there weren't intra-session recesses. This wasn't some framework that the framers anticipated how long recesses and sessions would be at the outset. It developed over time. There were intra-sessions really only during the holidays between Christmas and New Year. You know, that I think one can assume that that's often a time where much of the executive branch may also not be engaged.
But isn't the core issue in trying to divine what the recess thoughts were in the framers, the functioning of government so that the executive could carry out his or her responsibility in the functioning of government? So doesn't that inherently speak to some significant gap in time? In other words, which was, as Judge Mannion was suggesting with your opponent, usually a more significant time than we have today.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, I would.
Could we agree that it's to keep the government going, so to speak?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And when you just look back at the longstanding practice, I want to point out that we look to both the Senate's interpretation and the Attorney General's interpretation in 1921 that made clear, reaffirmed this authority, and the Congress itself in the Pay Act has authorized pay for intra-session recess appointees. Definitely congressional acquiescence here in the appointment of such people, and also there's a Comptroller General opinion, a legislative officer. And my colleagues on the other side have pointed to, for example, Daines and Moore as a situation where they're the lowest ever presidential authority because it's somehow in conflict with Congress. That just is not the scenario here. In fact, there is acquiescence and longstanding practice, and Daines and Moore look to that. They disregard the principle of Mistretta. The Supreme Court of Mistretta made clear that this type of longstanding practice is entitled to great weight and informs the meaning of the Constitution. And on the last point about intra-session, I'd like to go to, I think, the purpose, Your Honor. This is part of the separation of powers, the checks and balances. Yes, the appointment clause is the principal means for filling offices, a nomination with advice and consent. But Judge Flom, as you were pointing out, there may be longer sessions now, but during much of that time, the Senate is unavailable because they have gone on intra-session recess. And the Senate is just as much unavailable during an intra-session recess as during an inter-session recess.
But what is the necessity? And I suppose I don't want to diminish things, but there are minor offices. I'm not quite clear about the military, for example. Is it a general or somebody? Is there some level of rank that has to be approved by the Senate?
There is, and you're right. There are many dozens of those done at one particular time.
Those are routine unless something crops up or somebody says, hey, wait a minute, this guy or something. But for the most part, those are pretty routine. And I don't know whether we should be making a distinction. I can personally testify to a long recess between my first tie vote and the second tie vote. But I think, in my case, I wouldn't want an interim, whatever you want to call it, intra, while they were on vacation. And I think we look at things about what is the real necessity. And I think there are really important offices that obviously are going to be not necessarily controversial, but necessitate a lot of discussion, just as we've seen with Secretary of Defense here recently. And going on now, I forget which one. I think it's head of the Civil Rights Commission. But there are controversial things that will need a lot of discussion and time. What about acting? Does that fill the necessity?
No, Your Honor. It doesn't, particularly for certain positions where there are, you can imagine the most sensitive security clearances or special actions where, and there was a whole framework of regulations all in the Department of Justice, for example, where certain acting officials cannot approve certain national security type measures and that type of thing. So it isn't satisfying. I agree, they're very different types of appointments. But I think one of the appointments Judge Rovner made, which is very good, is the separation of powers, the checks and balance here, is that these appointments are temporary. They may last for long periods of time. Sometimes in the old days, some intercession lasted for a very long time. We have an example of one judge that lasted for more than a year. Again, no one knew at the beginning how long the various sessions and recesses were going to be, so that duration isn't determinative in that sense. But that's the balance that was struck. These are temporary appointments. And the Senate has it within its power to always override that by staying in session and available to provide advice and consent. But if they're not available to provide advice and consent, they are not engaging in the back and forth that was envisioned by the appointment. And so in order for certainly the executive to fulfill his duties to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, a duty that is 24/7, and to fill vacancies that arise and to avoid a vacuum, the design, that the wonder of the design was to allow this other power that was only temporary, that does not eviscerate the power of the Senate. And I certainly think the history has demonstrated that there is no evasion by the president. One last thing I would like to say is one of the reasons they say our line isn't bright enough is because the executive has never claimed authority to make appointments in 3 days or less. We don't believe this session, this recess was. It was a 20-day recess, but has never claimed that authority because those smaller meals, sleep, rest, those are part of ordinary business. They're not the suspension of an ordinary business. And if you look, the Supreme Court has understood the pocket veto case in the Wright case, for example, in the analyzing the pocket veto, when we're looking to one the Senate was available to have a bill sent back from the president. They looked to the adjournment clause, and we're not saying it's identical. The adjournment clause has the 3-day limit, but it is a notion of what the framers understood to be a break that required bicameral consent. And something less than that just hasn't, and the executive has never claimed power for that. That doesn't make this too vague of a standard. Again, I urge the court to look at Morrison versus Olson. That is not a problem here. And I would like to switch just to the pro forma issue, if I may. Again, the Senate has not said that they were not in recess during that time. To the contrary, they said they were in recess on December 17th. They twice referred to it. They had a unanimous consent, no business conducted. The fact that legislation was passed on December 23rd in a different pro forma doesn't change that. That was changed into a working session. And indeed, any recess, undisputed, we would agree that there are recesses that are undisputably recesses where it's easier to come back and pass legislation because in these adjournments, often the Senate and the House will make them conditional and allow just the leadership to call them back. On the 20th Amendment, and I just, with all due respect, I would not concede that we agree with the concessions of the agreements that counsel have characterized us. We do not agree that the pro forma session on January 3rd necessarily fulfilled the 20th Amendment. The new session, we believe, began by operation of the 20th Amendment. When you look at the text, it makes clear that the only way that date can be changed is by law, and there was no law. So we don't believe that necessarily, this court need not decide that. This court need not decide whether or not they somehow fulfilled the purpose of the adjournment clause. We're focused on the recess appointments clause, and that was a 20-day recess. It was not somehow eliminated because there were pro forma 30-second gavels under a unanimous consent order that no business could be conducted. The Senate made quite clear we're not doing any business. They were unavailable to provide advice and consent. And in that time, that is when the recess appointments clause kicks in.
Joseph, I want to see the limits of this argument, General Brinkman. unfortunately, a senator dies, and the funeral's in Washington, and they the Senate is in session, but for that afternoon chooses to be in recess, or whatever we want to call it. We'll call it an intra-session thing. The president appoints that afternoon someone. That's okay, right? I mean, that's got to be permissible, right, under your view?
No, not under our view necessarily at all, Your Honor. That would be a much more difficult scenario, which one would have to very closely examine. The executive has never claimed that authority.
Well, I'm not suggesting a president who has some sophistication would do that, but I'm just trying to draw where lines, if they can be, because we've talked about 3 days, 20 days, as opposed to the formality of the quote, intersession, seemingly a little more identifiable, not quite as fluid as the intra-session debate. I just, that's why I raised, obviously, an somewhat extreme example, but I just wonder what the floor is on the intra. I mean, what is there a principled parameters, so to speak, on the intra session?
Certainly, if you look at the Office of Legal Counsel's opinion and the practices over centuries, the executive has not claimed anything less than 3 day in an intra session recess. Indeed, I believe the published opinions of the Office of Legal Counsel have perhaps given advice on making an appointment during a 10 or 9 day. There just is no history of abuse by the president. It is subject to review, Your Honor. And our touchstone is what the Senate has done in their 1901 report when they tried to determine what a recess constituted in the Attorney General's 1921 opinion. And that would not, those standards would be very difficult to meet with an afternoon. We've never claimed that because it's not a suspension of ordinary business. Part of ordinary business includes eating, sleeping, days of worship, week to week. A session goes week to week, and that is the ordinary business. It's interrupting that constitutes a recess. I see my time is up. Could I make just a couple points on the last happens argument? Everyone certainly does not agree, Your Honor. I have to say the Third Circuit did not reach this issue. I think that was just perhaps a misstatement. The D.C. Circuit, there was Judge Griffith declined to reach that issue also. But the Second, Ninth, and Eleventh Circuits have all ruled to the contrary on that. And talk about history. The employers have no answer to the fact that President George Washington twice exercised recess appointment authority that would be invalid under their happens argument. One party in a case has suggested that perhaps President Washington didn't know these vacancies existed beforehand. That is just unimaginable in the example where he appointed the U.S. Attorney to Kentucky. That seat had been empty for 4 years. He finally got it filled in 1796, and I'm not the history expert, but it had something to do with not wanting to enforce some excise tax, I think perhaps on whiskey. In addition, they have no answer to President Lincoln, who appointed Justice Davis to the U.S. Supreme Court in violation of their theory of the happens argument. Judge Rovner, you hit the nail right on the head about the problem with their textual argument. During the recess is the limit on the president's power to appoint. If they take that adjective clause or that modifying clause and make it modify the when the vacancy occurs, there's no limit on the president. That means so long as a vacancy arose during a recess under the theory, the president could continue to fill it, you know, into the future. No one. That's just not right. We would never claim that authority. No one agrees with that. I guess the last point I would make there again is we have congressional acquiescence again. The Noel Canning misunderstood the original statute back in the 1860s about the pay for recess appointees in vacancies that arose before the recess. That just deferred payment until they were confirmed. It wasn't some rejection of that. And the current Pay Act is another congressional acquiescence. And, of course, we have the Attorney General opinion from Attorney General Wirt from 1823. We're looking at almost 200 years on that point.
You're going to have when does the inter session appointment expire?
They expire at the end of the next session of Congress.
Which session?
The
interest session?
The no, during the session, not during the recess.
Well, yeah, in the next intersession.
Well, if it's whether it's an appointment during an intersession recess, a recess between sessions, or it's a recess during a session, it goes to the next session. And that makes sense, Your Honor, because certainly if you're appointed at the very beginning of one session, it could go to two sessions. But it might be that also the recess within the session was at the very end, and there's very a day when you come back, and there's not possible. There was no indication, no one has pointed to anything, that there was some thought that there was going to be some understandable length of recess appointments. They have varied greatly. And again, I point to a judicial example that we identified in our brief that went for more than a year. So, yes, they will last different lengths of time.
Now, I'm going to point it out just because if we're talking about a session ending, you're saying, well, an intra-session doesn't end until the inter-session ends.
Well, there's an intra-session
appointment.
It doesn't end until the end of the next session. That's right, Your Honor. But I think that that was to make clear that there was a, you know, an end point in sight. I don't think that at all suggests that next session meant that the recess was only between sessions. I mean, if you're in third grade and you're going, your next grade is fourth grade, it doesn't mean you're in the summer vacation to say next. I mean, they're trying to say because it says next session, the next grade, it means you're in between somehow. There's nothing to support that. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor, very much.
Mr. Schabelsky.
Your Honors, I would like to address two points. One is the issue about clear lines and bright rules, and the second is the historical record. In its opinion in Plout versus Spendthrift Farms, the Supreme Court made clear that a major feature of the doctrine of separation of powers is that it is a prophylactic device establishing high walls and clear distinctions, because low walls and vague distinctions will not be judicially defensible in the heat of interbranch conflict. That's the guiding principle here. There is a bright line, clear distinction available. It is the intercession appointment. Because contrast, the intercession interpretation, because contrast what we hear from the board. Even now, at this late date, they provide no textual support for their position in their brief that the president gets to decide, using whatever criteria he thinks is reasonable, when the Senate is in recess. There is no historical basis for that distinction. Nothing in any of the historical examples they have given acknowledge that the president has that authority to make that decision. And their rule has no limiting principle, much less one grounded in the Constitution. The board is not even consistent in how it describes this vague standard. Sometimes in its brief it says it's when the Senate is going to be, quote, functionally unavailable. And other times in its brief and its arguments, it says it's when the Senate is not, quote, genuinely able to render advice and consent. What do these standards mean? How long a break is long enough under their interpretation? They say 3 days is not enough, but they did one here in a three-day adjournment. What factors are relevant under this standard? Where do those factors come from? How do we weigh these factors? The point is, if their interpretation is adopted, the courts will be embroiled in endless litigation with every intercession recess, applying these murky standards on an ad hoc basis. In contrast, the intercession-only recess appointment is easy to apply. It's understandable for the two branches to know what the rules are and can guide their conduct accordingly. And further, the board's interpretation, at the end of the day, will devolve into the broad every intra-session adjournment interpretation. Because the factors that we sometimes hear about, well, are the senators in the well? Is there a secretary sitting in its office to receive an appointment, to receive a communique from the president? None of those come from the Constitution. But in any event, those are equally true if it's a weekend recess, a three-day weekend, a four-day weekend for the holiday season for Thanksgiving, or as the Senate now routinely does because they adjourn on Thursdays and come back on Monday. And on the historical record, at the end of the day, I mean, what the board is doing here is what Justice Scalia bemoaned once as entering a crowded cocktail party and looking over the heads of the guests for your friends who support you. The point is they look at isolated historical snippets, ignoring the throng of other guests that have a contrary view in the historical record, going back to the very first administrations. And really, at the end of the day, the unassailable fact is that other than two disputed attempts at intra-session recess appointments by President Johnson when he was battling his impeachment, and then the next one didn't occur until one by President Harding, then one by President Coolidge, and then starting after World War II. Of the 385 intra-session recess appointments, I believe it's about 300 have occurred since President Reagan. This is the situation the Supreme Court addressed in INS versus Chadra, involving the One House unilateral of veto case, where they said, look, just because this practice that goes back to the New Deal, with hundreds of examples since the New Deal, doesn't mean we are locked into that. That is not reflecting the historical founding view of the founders. That's the situation we have here, and we urge you to rule in our favor on that issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mielski. Thanks to all counsel. And that part of the case is taken under advisement. We'll now move on to the merits. And Mr. Andrews.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel for the petitioner, FTS International Propans. With respect to the labor issue, this case is about an election, a very close election by one vote, and we ask that you overturn the certification of Local 139 in that NLRB election because the night shift supervisor not only voted in that election, but he served as an observer on behalf of the union in that election. There's three points here that we need to address and to point out why, even under the substantial evidence and the de novo, both under any of these standards of review, this needs to be overturned. First, the board got it flat out wrong when they said there is no evidence that Barrett Oliver, the night shift supervisor, spoke on behalf of management. In fact, the record is replete with evidence even of Mr. Oliver himself testifying that, yes, he met with the eight members of his night shift crew each night at the start and gave them their assignments, and that he followed up with them after, and that he spoke on behalf of management in doing that.
What was the distinction of his job and Mr. Todd Rainey?
Interestingly, Mr. Todd Rainey works on the day shift, and he came and followed in employment Mr. Oliver. Mr. Oliver...
Aren't there 12-hour shifts?
There were 12-hour shifts each, yes, Your Honor.
Oliver at night and Rainey during the day?
Yes, Your Honor. During the day, another interesting factor that differentiates Mr. Rainey's work from Mr. Oliver's work is that on the day shift, there was a general plant manager also available to supervise the operation of the plant. But on the night shift, Mr. Oliver is alone. So if we were to follow the hearing officer's report and the board's essentially rubber stamping of that hearing officer's report, we would have a night shift without any supervision at all for 12 hours.
So is it your argument that Rainey and Oliver did not perform virtually identical functions on different shifts?
It is our argument that they did perform similar functions, but that on a day shift, ultimately what differentiates Rainey is that Daly is also present there on the day shift. And it's important to note that it's Oliver who taught Rainey the job, and that's throughout the record as well.
Yeah, I understand, of course, that Oliver trained Rainey, but conducting one-time training of your newly hired counterpart to do the same job, only on a different shift, doesn't mean that you are supervising that person. I mean, it seems to me either they're both supervisors or neither are supervisors.
Your Honor, the difference is that on the day shift, there is some other supervision available over Todd Rainey, and there was testimony that Todd Rainey had to check with Mr. Daly in order to do things. There's no one for Mr. Oliver to check with at night. Now, at times, he contacted his counterpart on the day shift to say, we're going to shut down. I want to let you know. And he said, that's okay, in reply. He's letting his counterpart know that when you get here in the morning, you're going to find the plant shut down so you can make the appropriate steps. But that does not, and that was what was used by the hearing officer to say that, see, he didn't act with independent authority. He had to check with someone else. But this someone else is the very person that he trained. It's the person that he taught who had the skills to run the different pieces of equipment.
Debbie Green?
Yes.
That distinction is, because both Rainey and Oliver voted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the way you're making your argument, really neither of them should have voted.
Well, Mr. Oliver definitely should not have voted.
I say because Rainey had a higher ranking supervisor, you could always check with him, or maybe didn't have the final decision, whereas Oliver, being without somebody present, had to make a phone call, otherwise he was making the decision.
Your Honor,
that's my only question here.
Yes. I think, again, the importance is that on the day shift, there was someone else that he had reported to, but Barrett Oliver had no one else to report to, and he was the ultimate authority on that shift. I see that my time has expired. I'd like to reserve.
Thank you, Mr. Andrews. Ms. Lancia?
Well, that one seems.
Are we going to have a response on that? Is it Lancia?
They lost Douglas Callahan for the National Labor Relations Board.
I'm sorry. I guess I have the name switched, Mr. Callahan. I apologize.
Sorry, one second.
Yeah, we do.
I'll be handling the labor issues on for the FTS case that Mr. Andrews was just addressing.
You're handling it on the FTS case, you say?
Exactly. Representing the board on the FTS case, my colleague, Ms. Lancia, will be handling the bridge.
I had the name switched. we'll certainly, as the record will show, are giving sufficient time to these cases.
The board by no means rubber-stamped the hearing officer's report. The hearing officer's report, which was in and of itself thorough and well-reasoned, was actually pared down by the board. The board, in its footnote, limited the hearing officer's report to its finding that there was no independent judgment displayed by Barrett Oliver, and therefore he was not a supervisor under the Act. And in the comments from opposing counsel just a second ago, there was no discussion of what independent judgment Barrett Oliver displayed. Barrett Oliver's judgments that he made, so far as they're reflected in the record, were routine or clerical, automatic, mechanical. They didn't display any degree of sophistication, any discerning, comparing, or evaluating of data that would suffice to qualify him as a statutory supervisor and remove him from the protection of the Act.
Was anybody in charge at night?
In charge, there's no question that Barrett Oliver had some modicum of authority greater than the other employees on the shift, but was he in charge? It's hard to say. When Barrett Oliver had to make a major decision, for example, when the equipment came to a halt and it didn't seem like there was anything for the employees to do, Barrett Oliver got on the phone and called Todd Rainey and specifically asked for his permission before he sent the employees home. That's not the act of somebody who's in charge. And although opposing counsel claimed that the record does not reflect that, I would simply ask this court to look at the testimony cited in our brief on that issue. It's true that Barrett Oliver would, at the beginning of the shift, read aloud what people were going to be assigned for, what tasks they were assigned for the PM-AM shift. But those assignments had already been made by Todd Rainey. They had already been made by somebody else higher up in the company hierarchy. Barrett Oliver was merely reading off that schedule, performing a rote duty that in no way connotes the power to assign or a fortiori, the power to assign with independent judgment.
And if he wasn't there, is it true that the employees read their assignments off a sheet that had been, you know, written by the manager, made the same kinds of decisions themselves?
That is exactly the case, Your Honor. There were actually extended periods when Barrett Oliver wasn't even in the plant. Yet these plant, the employees on his shift knew what to do. They were self-starting employees, independent-minded, and they could handle themselves when Barrett Oliver was absent. One of the ways they would do that was simply go over to the pre-prepared sheet by Mr. Rainey and read off their assignments and then follow through. The employer emphasizes that this is a close election. It might have been a close election, but that in no way decreases the amount of deference owed to this certified election result. And on that same topic, the proper remedy would not be to overturn the certification in any event. The proper remedy would be to remand this case to the board for appropriate processing. If the court doesn't have any more questions for me.
Do you have any problem with me, obviously?
I can't. The board did not pass upon Rainey's ability to vote or not.
But, I mean, he was, well, you've already indicated, he had a higher position in the company than did Oliver.
If there was, there is certainly a, there's
well,
potentially more evidence. Yes?
You said that because Oliver had checked with Rainey. Rainey set up with the schedule for Oliver to dispense at night.
Right.
So obviously he's superior, has a higher position than Oliver.
He's superior. He had greater duties, more authority. If anybody, if as between Oliver and Rainey, one person were assigning employees, it was definitely Rainey. The hearing officer in his report did not find that Rainey was a supervisor. That was not a finding that was accepted to by the union when before the board. Therefore, the board never passed upon it. And we're not sure exactly how the board would have come out on that issue, whether the board would have found that Rainey, in making these assignments, was exercising independent judgment. Incidentally, Rainey himself was not making those assignments totally on by himself. The plant manager was reviewing, had ultimate editorial control over those assignments.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Callahan.
Your Honors, there's two points here that we really need to address, and that is notice does not equal permission. And if we look to the record at Joint Appendix 1026, we find the testimony of Sandy Haskins, who was an observer to that conversation. She testified that she watched as Barrett Oliver notified Todd Rainey that he was going to be closing down early because of the storm and sending everyone home. So notice does not equal permission. And this really gets us to the second point, and that is the inconsistency in the hearing officer's report, which was essentially rubber stamped by the board. And that inconsistency is this. By pointing to a lack of independent judgment and citing this request for permission on one hand and saying Oliver had to go get permission from the very person that he trained, Todd Rainey, it simply doesn't make sense. Todd Rainey at one point even reported on the night shift to night shift supervisor Barrett Oliver. That's at the record at Joint Appendix 744. So there he is. The same guy is reporting to him. It makes no sense that suddenly now he's his boss when just because he's on a day shift on a different shift. So to point to a lack of independent judgment by pointing to consultation with or notification of his counterpart on a day shift or someone who works on the day shift as a crew leader, that just doesn't make sense to show a lack of independent judgment. So I think we really do address the independent judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Person?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Greg Robertson. I'm also with Hunton & Williams. I'm here representing Big Ridge on the labor part of the case. The only labor law issue presented to the court in this case is whether the ALJ's opinion approved by the board is supported by substantial evidence in deciding whether Wade Waller, a Big Ridge employee, was discharged for his union activities. This case arose in the context of a union election where one union was seeking to supplant another. In other words, the mine had always been union represented. And the analysis in the case is generally governed by the board's right-line case, as informed and interpreted by several decisions of this court, including some opinions, Judge Mannion, that you've authored in both the Weiss Hospital, Sears Roebuck, and others. There are a number of points I'd like to make. I think time limits me to one, and it is this. This court has made it absolutely clear that in these kinds of cases, it is up to the board to prove that the decision-maker harbored anti-union animus and the decision-maker was motivated by that animus when he made the decision. This court said in one case, what matters is the anti-union animus of the decision-making supervisor who fired the charging party. In the Weiss case, the board said, and Judge Manning, you said, that the question is whether that decision-maker is substantially motivated by that anti-union animus. The ultimate decision-maker in this case was a fellow named Thomas Benner. Thomas Benner actually was a corporate executive who didn't work day-to-day at that mine, but rather had oversight of authority over several different mines. Nowhere in the ALJ's opinion is there any finding that Thomas Benner harbored anti-union animus. Nowhere in this opinion is there any finding by the ALJ that Thomas Benner was motivated by anti-union animus when he made the decision to fire Wade Waller.
But on the merits, the hearing officer simply seems to have believed Waller over Kerner on what really happened. How do we reverse a credibility finding like that at this point? In Waller's version, his truck was already stopped. He was simply unloading, and he disagreed with an order to stop unloading only after he asked why the order was given. And that wouldn't be a safety issue, would it be?
Your Honor, I have two responses. I don't think you need to do that to decide this case. What you need to decide is whether the decision-maker was motivated by anti-union animus, and there is no finding that he was, nor is there any proof that he was. That is a burden of proof carried by the board under Rightline, and if they don't meet it, this case needs to be reversed. But secondly, Your Honor, as to your point, here's what I would say. It is certainly a high burden to overturn credibility findings. But this ALJ did not nitpick the testimony of Wade Waller the same way he did as Kerner. What he decided was that Waller's conduct that night was static, isolated, and only happened for a course of 30 seconds. But read Kerner's testimony. Kerner's testimony was that he told Waller time after time over the radio what he had to do, and Waller said repeatedly, I'm not going to stop. I don't care how many times you flag me. And the reason that Benner found that conclusively important is because they had a fatality at that mine just a year and a half before, involving someone driving the same vehicle as Waller in the same location around one of these feeders. And that fatality resulted in the Mine Safety and Health Administration ordering the company to institute a whole new set of procedures, including hiring somebody to be a feeder watcher. That's what Kerner did. And so when Kerner gave instructions and Waller recklessly said, I'm not following those instructions, to Benner, and this is his testimony and it's uncontradicted, to Benner, that was the critical fact. The problem here is, and why this is so important, is the vehicle driven by Waller is 30 feet long. It weighs 10 tons. It moves at 10 to 20 miles an hour in a confined space in the dark. Even under the best of safety procedures, it's not an undangerous place. And Kerner, the question of whether what Kerner really thought about this, when Waller repeatedly throughout the shift, not just at the one instance at the feeder, which is what the judge wanted to narrow this down to, if you look at Kerner's testimony, it was all night long. When you look at Benner's recitation of what bothered him, it was not the one instance, it was all night long. The problem here is when that happened, Kerner called his supervisor, asked to change positions that night to get out of the way in case Waller was going to meet his threat, changed shifts later, and wound up having two medical events as a result of how all this impacted him.
I can see that effect on him. I'm curious, though, about this stop signal. Was it an intersection of some kind? Was it when you get proximate to the feeder, or was it you got to stop because the feeder's full? I don't know quite what the stop was that he was disobeying.
Yes, sir, and it could be either one. The isolated incidents that the judge, the ALJ, focused on was sitting at the feeder and whether it was full or not. What Kerner testified was that Waller told him all night long and that whenever he got a signal, he wasn't going to obey it. And that signal could have been because there was somebody in and around, standing around that feeder who shouldn't have been there, who wandered into a position they shouldn't have been in, or it could have been for a host of other things. If you just narrow it down to sitting at the feeder, well, then it seems like just an employment dispute. But if what you have is an employee driving a 10-ton truck, telling the guy who the cop, and that's what Kerner was, the cop, by MSHA's decision, he was the cop. If you got the guy telling the cop, I'm not following your instructions, I don't care what you tell me, then you've got a real problem on your hands. And whatever anybody else thought about this, the question is what Benner thought about it, because he made the decision. And the only question that we think that is important here is, did he have anti-union animus? And there's no finding that he did, but most importantly, is was he animated in his decision by that animus if he did have it? And there's no finding that he did, and there's no evidence in the record that he had that animus. And that's dispositive of the case.
All right.
I'll save some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Lanza?
May it please the Court. My name is Nicole Lancia, and I represent the Board in Big Ridge, seeking enforcement of its order because the company has not contested numerous violations of Section 8A1, including hallmark threats of mine closure and job loss, and also because substantial evidence supports the Board's finding that Wade Waller was unlawfully discharged, as the flagging incident furnished the excuse rather than the reason for his discharge. I would first like to respond to a few of counsel's points. As to the facts, the ALJ actually assumed for purposes of analyzing the Section 83 discharge Kerner's version of events that night, that Waller said to him, you can flag me all you want and I won't stop. However, in the context in which that statement was made, it's clear, and Kerner admitted, that Waller was parked and stopped at the feeder dumping coal. Kerner was afraid that the machine would gob out or overflow and flagged him with his helmet light to stop what he was doing. And Waller, as an experienced miner, who was trying to get the mine's production numbers up and for that specific crew, disregarded that signal. But that was in no way a threat on Kerner's life or a threat to run him over, as the company seeks to point out. Also, the company repeatedly mentions Kerner's medical events and reactions to this incident. However, at the time Waller was discharged, neither Gossman or Benner knew of Kerner's reaction to the incident with Wade Waller, so that could not have formed the basis for his discharge. As to counsel's point about the decision makers having animus, this court is well aware that the board may rely on both direct and circumstantial evidence in order to infer animus. And here, there is a plethora of circumstantial evidence, particularly the company's shifting justifications for Waller's discharge from the time that he was discharged to its the hearing and briefs before the board, and even to its briefs before this court. At the hearing, the company, Benner specifically, said that the real issue for Waller's discharge was the flagging incident. And Gossman also relied on that and another alleged incident with Kirk that the ALJ found not to have occurred. At the time of his discharge, Gossman performed a cursory interview at best after Benner directed him to terminate him, depending on the results of the interview. Came in there with a pre-written termination letter in pocket, and asked him about a confrontation, a verbal confrontation with Craig, which he readily admitted and which would never have warranted his discharge, Waller's discharge from the mine, given the company's tolerance of threats in the past. They asked whether he threatened to run over another employee, which Waller vehemently denied. And they asked whether he said, F you, all you effing scabs, in the bathhouse, which he also denied. Based on an honest admission and two emphatic denials, Gossman handed him this termination letter, which mentioned nothing about safety, though the company had post hoc has sought to rely on that. It mentioned no specific conduct whatsoever and merely said that Waller and other employees had been implicated in threatening or intimidating behavior. However, now the company has attempted to make this case about safety and fabricated an alleged pattern of escalating behavior. But the evidence, the credited record evidence, shows that there was no such pattern, and even the incidents which the incident which Waller admitted occurred with Craig would never have warranted his termination. The other incidents that formed that alleged pattern of behavior either never occurred or were not a safety threat as the company portrays it.
Well, we can distinguish, I guess, between Waller's, we'll call it aggressive expression of being pro-union and total disdain for those, as you call it, scabs who were opposed to the union. Now, that's the way he operated, and I guess that's not the issue. I guess the issue is whether they had anti-union animus making the decision to get rid of him because of his very active support for the union. And it was a relatively close vote. So obviously, there's a lot of division there in the company. I guess you would make that distinction between what his personal attitude was and his behavior, which didn't sound very complimentary to how he treated other people and they were on his side, versus his performance and whether it was really anti-union animus that caused him to, or does it matter, anti-union animus.
Well, as to the, I think, first point of Your Honor's question, Waller was highly respected, a well-liked, good employee who had worked at the mine for 7 years. He had never been disciplined for any infraction, safety-related or otherwise, and had never even been called into the management office with any accusations of misconduct until 1 week after the union won the election. However, here... the fact that he did have such good performance and that if the company, as they seem to rely on the flagging incident, if that is the reason that they claim to have discharged him, the fact that mine manager Lawrence was aware of that after Kerner reported it to him, asked Waller about it, which he denied, threatening to run him over, and let him go back to work and even assigned him overtime shifts, under this court's precedent, particularly in Jetstar, that's demonstrative, and it comports with the board's other findings of circumstantial evidence that support the company's union animus and the fact that that animus played a role in Waller's discharge. The company undisputedly knew of Waller's strong pro-union activity. He was the leading union advocate at the mine. They were fully aware of that. And I don't think we should gloss over the numerous uncontested Section 8A1 violations, which occurred during the company's aggressive anti-union campaign, through the time of the election, and even after the election, and were pervasive throughout the mine at various levels of management, from low-level production supervisors to group executive Menchez, who is a third or fourth down, top-down official. That, in conjunction with the company's shifting justifications, as well as the disparate discipline that it issued to Waller in light of its historical tolerance of verbal threats of injury and even physical confrontations at the mine, supports the board's finding of animus here and that Waller was unlawfully discharged.
You know, you make him sound like an angel, but from the pages of the brief, it truly does seem as if Waller was somewhat foul-mouthed, rule-breaking.
Well, it's actually sort of
a mine safety nightmare type individual.
Well, actually, to speak to that, it's important, I think, to understand the workplace at Big Ridge and how the miners talked all the time. They used profanity and vulgarity on a regular basis. This was maybe something for me and you would probably be vulgar and worthy of disdain at the mine was just accepted. And the company had accepted that before. And the company had also accepted employees threatening to get their guns to shoot each other and managers throwing each other to the floor and failed to discipline them. Even if employees did shove each other, they only got 3-day suspensions. But here, after a cursory interview and investigation at best, the company chose to discharge Wade Waller clearly because of his strong union sympathies in light of the union's recent election victory. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Valencia.
Mr. Robertson.
Just as a point, Your Honor, and well, it's not directly on point, I don't think any of us can think that that song and the words of that song have any place in anywhere. But here's the point. This guy engaged in the vulgar conduct, the effing scab conduct. He did all of that. He sang the song on the radio, and while I really don't want you to read the words of the song to really grasp who this guy was, read them. He sang it on the radio. He had stickers. He did everything. And he wasn't fired for any of it. Here's the thing. I've been doing this for 35 years. I've read a lot of cases about employers who fire pro-union people, pro-union advocates, to help them win the election. Usually you do that before the election. Here, they didn't fire him before the election. They fired him afterwards. And they didn't fire him for his song or his vulgarity, and they didn't actually fire him for his threats. They fired him based on conduct that occurred after the election was over and the announcement of the results were done, and Mr. Waller was all joyous of having won the case, having won the election. That's not the story of somebody who's harboring anti-union animus to fire somebody to gain advantage in an election. The ALJ's finding remains as is, and she didn't touch it. There is nothing about Benner having anti-union animus and nothing about Benner being motivated in his decision. Benner came in, he met with folks, he was on a phone call, he got all the evidence, and he made a decision. And his decision was, and his testimony is uncontradicted, what bothered me was this guy's conduct underground with Kerner in violation of these MSHA rules that we put in because of that fatality. That's serious enough to warrant discharge. Not pre-election discharge, post-election discharge and post-election conduct. You don't win an election by harassing union people after the election's over. That motivation here just doesn't cut it. It doesn't wash. The question is Benner's motivation, and they didn't prove it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Again, thanks to all counsel. Both cases are taken under advisement.